This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador hours after an Iranian national with a British passport was executed in Tehran over spying for the United Kingdom. The Syrian foreign minister warns Damascus will give a crushing response to the death and damage caused by Israeli attacks on Syrian soil. And people hold a funeral for two Palestinian men killed by Israeli regime forces in the occupied West Bank. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to World News. An Iranian national with a British passport has been executed for spying for the UK government and, quote, extensive action against Iran's national security. Alireza Akbari was sentenced to death more than 2 years ago after he was arrested. According to a court ruling, Akbari began working with the UK spy agency, the MI6, under the guise of research and trade activities. He had numerous meetings with UK agents in different countries over a long period. He passed on intelligence on key issues, including Iran's domestic and foreign policies, as well as missile and defense programs. Akbari also gave the UK information about nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated in November of 2020. Britain has reacted to the execution, saying it will temporarily withdraw its ambassador from Tehran, among other issues.
The UK government made it clear that we would respond. And therefore, in response to this execution, we have summoned the Iranian charge d'affaires. We have imposed sanctions against the prosecutor general. And we have also decided to temporarily withdraw our ambassador for further consultations.
James cleverly said that Britain's response will not necessarily be limited to these measures, and the country will try to deter similar action by Iran. Earlier, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the British ambassador to Tehran to lodge protests against what it called uncustomary UK intervention in matters concerning Iran's national security. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and Damascus have agreed to prepare a long-term cooperation agreement and implement it in the near future. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a joint presser with his Syrian counterpart, Faisal Miqdad, following their meeting in Damascus. He said two sides explored ways of deepening economic and trade relations. Amir Abdollahian also touched on recent diplomatic contacts between Syria and Turkey. He said Tehran has long been trying to help settle issues between Damascus and Ankara and is excited about the results.
When we found out that the Turkish military might attack northern Syria, we started efforts to prevent a new war and assault. We are happy that Iran's diplomatic efforts and talks between the president of Iran, Syria, and Turkey resulted in dialogue. We believe that the sovereignty and territorial integrity of countries should be respected. We will continue our diplomatic efforts to resolve problems between Damascus and Ankara.
Miqdad, for his part, said relations between Tehran and Damascus are on a strategic level, and the two sides are now working to remove obstacles for closer economic cooperation. The top Syrian diplomat said normalization with Turkey depends on the end of its military occupation of parts of the country. Miqdad noted that Syria will never forget death and damage caused by Israeli attacks on Syrian soil, insisting the country will give a crushing response to the strikes in due course. The Iranian minister arrived in Damascus earlier today following a two-day visit to Lebanon, where he sat down for talks with the country's top officials. Our correspondent Mohammad Ali joined us earlier with details about Iran's foreign minister's trip to the Syrian capital.
Probably the most important topic was the developments on the Turkish-Syrian, of course, talks. Now, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said Syria will not press ahead with such talks if the goal of such talks was not to end Turkish occupation of Syrian territories and end Turkish support to terrorist groups inside Syria. For his part, Mr. Abdel Lahyan said any serious dialogue is a between, of course, Syria and Turkey is a positive step for both countries and for the region. Mr. Abdel Lahyan said he expressed actually a trust in Syria's decisions and stances in this regard. Abdel Lahyan also then held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, Dr. Faisal Miqdad, focusing in their discussions on boosting economic and trade relations between both countries. And during that press conference that you just mentioned, Mr. Abdullahian said the Syrian-Iranian relations are currently at the best condition. And he said that both countries are working hard now to boost their economic relations in order to have them on the same level of their political relations. Mr. Al-Miqdad, Faisal Al-Miqdad, Syria's foreign minister, also said the relations between both countries are strategic, and he said that soon there will be steps taken that will show everyone, the entire world, the depth of relations between the two countries and both countries' belief in the necessity of enhancing such relations. And
a funeral has been held for two Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Now, mourners attending the funeral reiterated their pledge to respond to Israeli atrocities. The two Palestinians were shot during an Israeli raid on a village near the city of Jenin. Israeli troops opened fire on a car they were traveling in. One of the victims was pronounced dead on the spot, while the other later died in a hospital. Also on Saturday, another Palestinian succumbed to wounds he sustained during an Israeli raid near Jenin earlier this month. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories in recent months. More than 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since early last year. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, explains why the Israeli regime has intensified its crackdown against Palestinians.
It seems that the Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating, and is cracking down on not only Palestinian fighters, as we are saying, because they include children, they include civilians as well. The Israelis are targeting as well the general population here in the occupied territories. At the end of the day, Palestinians warn that more aggressive, let's say, policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu is expected, because Netanyahu and the Israeli military wants to prove to the Israelis and the settlers in a way or another that they control the Palestinian territories. They would prevent Palestinian resistance, any form of resistance. And in the last year, over 180 Palestinians were killed. Many of them were known as Palestinian fighters, members of the newly formed groups, whether the Jenin Battalion or the Lion's Den in Nablus. So the Israeli regime doesn't want for Palestinians to be engaged in any form of resistance, and they don't want them, of course, to be engaged in confrontations and armed resistance and to shoot at the Israeli soldiers and the settlers.
Now in Tunisia, clashes erupt between police and people protesting in the capital, Tunis, against the government of President Kais Saied. Clashes happened after riot police tried to disperse angry protesters who accused President Kais Saied of power grab in the country. Protesters were also angry over rising prices, blaming the government for the economic crisis in the North African country. Anger has been boiling in the North African country since Saeed shut down the elected parliament in 2021 and began to reshape the political system. The rallies coincided with the anniversary of the 2011 popular uprising that led to the ouster of longtime ruler Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Joining us now from London is Mr. Jonathan Ofensa, publisher at Africa Briefing, for more on the story. Hello, Jonathan. Always a pleasure to pick your brain when it comes to many things related to Africa, especially what we're seeing in Tunisia these days. Your thoughts initially on how popular is President Saeed's structural reforms when it comes to constitutional reforms and power reforms that somehow only benefit him and his close cronies? How popular are they? And if you feel they're not, why isn't he not responding to all the protests, all the blowback, all the opposition, and so many deaths that have resulted as a result?
Well, to gauge the popularity, how popular he is or not, you know, you can gauge it by the protest that took place today. Okay, I mean, as you said in your report, Saeed has sat down the elected parliament in 2021 and it's begun to reshape the political system. But the low turnout for last December's legislative election, you know, tells you, you know, how unpopular his policies are and how unpopular he himself is, because that new parliament elected is mostly powerless, okay? And again, the economy is failing, right? And staple foods are disappearing from the shelves. The government has not even yet been able to secure an international bailout, with the state finances also facing bankruptcy. So Saeed is very, very unpopular right now. Hence the many, you know, the huge protests that are taking place, you know, against him today.
So then when he is this unpopular, why are we not seeing, especially when he sees so much power and it's been done in the under the penumbra of a period where the country was moving very close to a democracy, to a righteous democracy? A lot of people feel this is a huge step backwards. Why is not the military not standing behind the people, Jonathan?
Well, I'm not sure the military has the appetite, because, look, we shouldn't forget that these protests today is exactly 12 years of the beginning of the Arab Spring that ousted the late autocrat Ben Ali, okay? And it was not, Ben Ali was not deposed by the military, he was deposed by popular mass uprising, okay? But the thing is, the various political forces, including, I mean, most parties and the labor union that oppose science projects cannot come together, are not able to bridge their differences, right? And oppose them effectively. So that this is the weakness that Saeed has been exploiting, you know, to stay in power.
And before that, you go, when you mentioned how unpopular his reforms and his power grab is within the country, when we step outside of Tunisia, when it comes to Western governments or some of Saeed's even allies in Africa, where do they stand on what he's doing to the country?
Well, they are not. You see, the West and also maybe his allies, you know, within Africa, you know, are not. We are just watching to see how events unfold. I'm not sure there's going to be any external involvement, you know, in the way, you know, things are happening in Tunisia at the moment. So they want to see and watch and let things take their natural course. That's my take on it.
Thank you, Jonathan. Stay safe. From London, Mr. Jonathan Ofensa, publisher at Africa Briefing, joining us. Now, fighting rages on in the Ukrainian town of Soledad in eastern Donetsk region amid conflicting reports on the fate of the fiercely contested town. Ukrainian officials say they still have control of the front line there, that after Russia claimed it had taken over the salt mining town on Thursday, calling the victory an important step in its offensive. Meanwhile, explosions were heard in several Ukrainian regions on Saturday, including the capital of Kyiv. The Ukrainian presidential office said the critical infrastructure facilities were the target of the air raids. Russia has been pounding Ukraine's vital sectors, including its power grid, with missiles and drones since October, causing blackouts and disruptions. Earlier, our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, updated us on the battle for the town of Soledar.
The Ukrainians still saying that it hasn't, but now they're saying that Soledar isn't a very strategic town. It is a strategic town, and that's why the Ukrainians put up such a stiff resistance there. Right now, we're seeing some of the most brutal fighting, perhaps the most brutal fighting in the war so far. Dozens, probably hundreds, particularly Ukrainian soldiers, are getting killed or wounded every day. And Soledar is important because it makes it more likely for the Russians to be able to take Bakhmut. And Bakhmut is heavily fortified. The Russians have been trying to take that for months. So that'll be the next target for Russia. We're not really seeing any calls for peace at the moment, as Russia seems to have lost faith in Ukraine and NATO to negotiate for peace. And NATO has made clear that the only way they want to win this war is by sending more weapons. So critical days, weeks, and months ahead in this war on the front lines. There seems to be a lot of movement in Belarus. And Ukrainians are taking that seriously. As I say, we may well have some massive news in the coming days or weeks of a new, huge new offensive, or we may not. It's just very difficult to know at the moment. But certainly that's a major possibility, an invasion from Belarus. Or as I say, it may just be a ruse, and we may well see an attack from elsewhere. Or we may well just see the Russians concentrating on their artillery barrage of Bakhmut and trying to win the fight for that city.
U.S. police brutality takes another victim. Unarmed African-American Keenan Anderson dies just hours after he was repeatedly tasered and restrained by Los Angeles police following a traffic accident.
Now! Get down over there! Turn over on your stomach right now! Turn over on your stomach right now! Turn over!
Please don't do this, sir! Please! Help me, please!
You know what?
Help me, please! No, please, help me! Please, 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 please. You're trying to do it for me. You're trying to do it.
Stop
for
it.
Me.
Stop it. I'm going to tase you. I'm going to tase him.
You're trying to kill me. You're trying to kill me.
Leave me alone.
Stop it.
Now, Anderson, a 31-year-old teacher and father, is also cousin of the Black Lives Matter movement's co-founder, Patrice Cullors. Anderson went into cardiac arrest several hours after this encounter on January 3rd. Los Angeles police released body cam footage of the incident after it sparked public outcry. They say Anderson tried to run away from the car crash. Cause of his death has still not been officially determined. The Black Lives Matter movement says Anderson was killed by police. His death brings to three the number of people killed in encounters with LA police in less than a week. Police brutality against people of color has been a source of public outcry in the U.S. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Wall Street Bank's chief strategist says the U.S. equities may fall another 22% from current levels. The U.S. stocks has faced massive drop, he says. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT reported U.S. stocks are expected to undergo much sharper declines than most of the pessimistic projections outlined, according to Michael Wilson, Morgan Stanley's chief U.S. equity strategist, as quoted by Bloomberg. In a research note seen by the agency, the analyst said the recession would exacerbate the biggest annual decline in the equity market since the global financial crisis. Wilson added that the S&P 500 could drop much lower than the 3,500 to 3,600 points that the market is currently estimating in the event of a mild recession. The consensus could be right directionally, but wrong in terms of magnitude, he said, adding that the benchmark could bottom around 3,000 points, or some 22%, as against current levels. The analysts warned, however, that while a peak in inflation would bolster bond markets, it's also very negative for profitability. Margins will continue to disappoint through 2023, he added. Meanwhile, analysts at Goldman Sachs reportedly expect a positive impact from China's post-COVID economic reopening to get overshadowed by pressure on profit margins, changes to U.S. corporate tax policies, along with looming recession. Deutsche Bank Group strategists also say that U.S. earnings would decline during the current year, 2023, adding that stocks could rally through the fourth quarter reporting season due to a year-end sell-off and to low investor positioning. Meanwhile, Forbes magazine has reported the world's billionaires have had a tough year, having lost nearly $2 trillion combined in 2022 after adding trillions to their collective fortunes in the previous 2 years. According to its estimates, American billionaires were the hardest hit, losing $660 billion collectively amid the plunge in tech stock prices due to rising interest rates, soaring inflation, and a worsening economy in the U.S. The report highlighted that Tesla and Twitter CEO Elon Musk saw his fortune diminish the most. Musk's net worth nosedived by about $115 billion last year, Forbes calculated. Tesla's stock price is down nearly 70% for the year. Although Musk lost his crown as the world's richest person last year, he's still the wealthiest in the U.S. with a net worth of nearly $139 billion as of December 27, 2022, according to Forbes. And while Musk is the biggest loser of 2022, according to the publication, he's not the only billionaire whose net worth took a hit. The five other U.S. billionaires who lost most in 2022, according to Forbes, are Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos, Meta Platforms, Facebook's parent company, co-founder Mark Zuckerberg, Google co-founder and board member Larry Page, Nike chair Phil Knight, the Estee Lauder company's chair Emeritus Leonard Lauder. The report also showed that the number of billionaires has fallen to from 2,671 to 2,523 per Forbes real-time tracker, as high-profile moguls like FTX Sam Bankman-Fried, Kanye West, and Rivian founder RJ Scarings have dropped the ranks. Inflation in the United States hit 40-year highs in the summer 2022, pushed up by soaring prices. Official data shows the rate has slowed down since then, with the consumer price index settling at 7.1% in November, down from a 7.7% gain in the previous month. The CNBC research pointed out that while inflation has impacted the millionaires' spending, they are split when it comes to making changes in their investment portfolios. When asked about that, 29% reported they have already made changes, while another 11% said they are just planning to do so. Nearly a third, about 30%, said they might or might not make changes, and 31% said they are not planning any changes. According to Wolper, millionaire investors are keenly aware of the impact of higher rates on their investments and the need to shift their portfolios, but they are uncertain about what exact actions to take. He explains they are not sure where they should make changes. People don't want to try to market time. The CNBC Millionaire Survey was reportedly conducted online in November with a total of 761 people polled.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is some food for thought regarding the all-glorious Creator whom imagination cannot encompass, as described by Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, who is one without partner, he who cannot be perceived with vision, neither be described with tongues, nor can imagination surround his state.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of the nurturing process when it comes to teaching and training our children how to pray Salah. Salah being an important act of worship in the Islamic religion, we find an important strategy and method to teach Salah and nurture our children into Salah is by exhibiting and showing them role models who are good prayers of Salah, who are good people who pray Salah properly. And indeed, Rasulullah himself was one of those individuals whose prayer was at its peak, and likewise the holy infallible Imams as well. But it is very important that as the children wish to incorporate Salah in their lives, they are able to observe somebody over a good span of time, and who better than their own parents to begin with, to exhibit and demonstrate for them the proper method of Salah. And as this is the case, therefore it is very important that the parents themselves are praying Salah in the best possible way, because obviously on one hand, a person cannot teach verbally all the different aspects of Salah. It needs to be demonstrated. There are certain aspects of Salah which one might not be able to explain verbally clearly. Rather, the children need to be able to picture it. They need to conceptualize it so that they themselves can act upon it and implement it in their Salats. Indeed, we know that the Holy Prophet himself would role model Salah in the best possible way, and his companions would clearly note down the different aspects of the Salah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, and they would even specifically mention the different spiritual states that he would be in that were embodied by the changes in his physical appearance. That Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, whenever he would stand for prayer, as the companions narrate, the color of his face out of the fear of Allah would change, and his chest would move and shake, and his breathing would become so fast as if a pot of water was boiling. And this is an example that has been struck. And this is an analogy that has been provided to us by the companions, on one hand, explaining to us how Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi would pray. On the other hand, we find that Imam al-Sadiq narrates from his father, Imam al-Baqir, regarding his father, Imam Zain al-Abidin, that when Imam would stand to pray, he was still, such that as if a tree is still and a light wind, a breeze blows its leaves and its branches, but the tree itself stands still. And this was the method that the A'imma themselves and the Masumin themselves exhibited and demonstrated for the ones around them, such that they learned from it. And likewise, we need to be demonstrating Salah in the most perfect manner for our children, such that they are able to learn from it likewise. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodile seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations. A wide range of cutting-edge digital technology is grabbing the limelight at the 2022 China International Fair for Trade in Services, which is underway in Beijing. The exhibition is featuring a wide range of products, including artificial intelligence, virtual reality, metaverse, and 5G. Visitors can be seen taking virtual reality driving lessons and enjoying scenarios, including different road and weather conditions, wearing VR kits. It's the leading and largest comprehensive fair for trade and services in China. This year, an increasing number of traditional service companies are speeding up their transformations, resorting to smart technologies. The event has set up 9 thematic exhibitions, including cultural and tourism services, education and sports services, hygiene and health services, engineering, consulting, and environmental services. Foam is fun to play with, particularly for kids, but when it's mixed with art, it also becomes a grown-up matter. And that's what a German artist has done, creating a sea of rainbow-colored foam as an interactive art piece and allowing the audience to enjoy themselves and become part of the art. Colors mixed were by Stephanie Luning were turned into rainbow-hued foam cascading down the stairs. The performance was called Island of Foam, version 18. Excited children jumped in as soon as the bubbly sea reached the base of the stairs, delighted to be playing in the rainbow playground. The art piece is made up of largely of water and a food coloring. The artist says she loves working in public spaces and reaching a broad audience of all ages.
Because I like to be surprised by the result myself, and I like to work with this that you never know how it's going to turn out. You have the wind, the weather conditions, the locations, the audience. You never know how the people are going to respond and how the artwork turns out. And that's really what I like a lot, and also how to reach a broad audience.
However, Stephanie says there's tons of work behind all the fun, and cleaning up the mess can be hard. Interactive art is a form of art that achieves its purpose by involving the audience. The immersive art piece is part of the Greenwich and Docklands International Festival, an annual festival of performing arts and outdoor theater.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Tehran Saray Gallery takes part in a massive art exhibition in South Korea, bringing Iran's leading and emerging artist to the Asian market. Works from 6 Iranian painters are displayed at the event, where hundreds of galleries account for more than $50 million in sales annually. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Seoul's annual global art exhibition has been reinvigorated this year with additional events and a most certain boost in attendance. The Korea International Art Fair continues an evolution that began with its launch back in 2002. This year features 164 galleries and more international exhibitors than ever before. That growing cosmopolitan experience and this region's growth as an art market hub is what brought a premier Iranian gallery to Seoul.
When we started this gallery, we had the big goal to just introduce Middle Eastern artists and Iranian artists to all over the world. So when you want to introduce artists, you cannot forget South Korea and Far East as well.
Sarai had participated in last year's art fair with paintings purchased by local Korean collectors. Expanding on that success at the event, and as Iranian artists are growing in international stature, Hassan Saradipour decided to display works from 6 Iranian artists at this year's event.
Our gallery focuses on the established and emerging artists. This artist, Abbas Nasashamlu, he just want to show that how the nature and how the human can affect to each other, how this experience he can bring it on the canvas, on the paper.
The massive exhibition featured paintings, although there were various multimedia and sculpture installations. As South Korean living standards have risen, more people have time and money to spend on such events. Their taste in art has also become more sophisticated.
South Korea used to lack art galleries compared to other countries. There was a serious lack of love for this level of culture. However, now these events, I think, create opportunities for more people to gain such appreciation.
For the first time this year, Freeze Art Fair in Seoul exhibited works from 110 galleries, including Picasso, other 20th century masters, and contemporary talents. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Animals, no matter pets or wild, are more vulnerable to drowning or dying in resulting floods and mudslides. A veterinarian school in Pakistan is offering free treatment for animals injured in the recent devastating floods. The veterinary surgery department of Sindh Agriculture University has set up a makeshift animal hospital as flooding hit humans and animals alike in the surrounding area. Volunteers have been providing anything from surgery to medicine and even ultrasounds to the animals free of cost. People from flood-affected areas can be seen bringing their farm animals such as goats, donkeys, buffaloes, and cows into the center. The worst floods in history have killed an estimated 800,000 farm animals. But there were many heartwarming videos trolling on social media showing people come to rescue animals being stuck hopelessly.
These days, computer technology is impacting every aspect of our life, providing a greater ability to place things, events, and people within context. An Iraqi museum has started using the technology and virtual reality headsets to make exhibits interactive and to bring scenes back to life. Visitors can explore heritage sites destroyed by terrorist groups. Now using thousands of photographs, a group of local engineers have given a virtual rebirth to five historic sites in Mosul and a broad the Nineveh province. That includes a mosque and its leaning minaret. But this museum brings sites back to life for the people who live in Mosul. Although large parts of the old city remain oceans of debris, authorities are trying to restore historic sites, mosques and churches in Mosul. A private museum along the Tigris River, which opened in mid-June, saw more than 4,000 visitors in its first month. Iran is famous for its hand-knotted carpets and ancient art which have been loved for centuries and are never going out of style despite changing tastes and increased competition from Asia. Striking geometric shapes that recall 20th century abstract art are what we expect to see in handmade Iranian rugs. But weavers and exporters have been forced to redesign a tradition dating back more than 2,000 years due to numerous problems. Carpet exporter Ahad Azimzadeh says, however, that a revolution is underway. Iranian rugs are known for dense, curving floral designs in rich colors. They were put on display in a recent exhibition that featured a rug with small squares of hypnotic diagonal blue and white lines and another depicting diamond and other patterns in gold silk. Some countries have overtaken Iran in the global market, but many say modern carpets will never replace the traditional ones which are deep-rooted in Iranian culture.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Successive UK Conservative governments have cut funding for the universal healthcare system. This has caused massive demonstrations and strikes before and after the new year 2023. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Throughout road in this regard, ambulance drivers in the UK are slated to strike on January 23rd following a strike in December when tens of thousands walked out protesting low pay. The average salary for an ambulance worker is £25,000 and also for the inability to deliver prompt, safe services to patients. Thousands of nurses also walked off the job to protest similarly abysmal conditions, as they have done in New York as well in recent weeks, where the healthcare workers have been protesting what they have described as unimaginable working conditions. The unions representing nurses in the UK have also planned additional labour actions over the coming weeks. The British National Health Service, NHS, which has been at the core of the UK social compact since the end of the Second World War, is being brought to its knees. The reasons are multiple: years of underfunding of basic services by the succession of Conservative governments that have ruled the UK since 2010, the stresses of the COVID pandemic, the exodus of skilled workers in the wake of Brexit, and the double-digit inflation that has driven thousands of nurses, ambulance workers, and other healthcare employees to seek more lucrative jobs in other fields. Between 2009 and 2019, NHS spending in real terms rose only 1.2% per year, rendering the service unable to keep up with the needs generated by a growing and rapidly aging population and with the increased cost of medicines and medical technology. More than 4,000 European doctors left the NHS in the wake of Brexit. Combined, Brexit, COVID, burnout, and low pay have also led to huge personnel turnovers in the nursing professions. The average pay of a nurse in the UK in 2023 is a little shy of £35,000, with the starting pay at roughly £27,000. For hourly workers, the estimated average pay for a UK nurse is just shy of £18, or about $24. By contrast, the average hourly salary for a registered nurse in US is $43 per hour, and nurses can also expect an average of $12,000 a year in overtime pay. That's not far from double what the UK pays its nurses. Meanwhile, stories abound of elderly people waiting half a day or more for ambulances to arrive to take them to overstretched accident and emergency rooms that no longer have the capacity to promptly admit and process new patients. Even critically ill patients, for whom every minute can be a matter of life or death, often wait hours for help to arrive. The average wait time for ambulance crews to reach heart attack victims is now nearing 2 hours in some parts of the country. And once the ambulance does pick up a patient and drive them to hospital, they frequently then have to idle at hospital entrances for hours, waiting for a bed to open up so that they can unload their patients. In large part, hospital beds are at a premium because thousands of patients who are ready to be discharged into the community cannot be sent home because supportive services have been slashed to the bone by recent governments, and so there are no facilities and staff available outside of hospital settings to care for the released but still healing patients, especially those who are elderly and have an array of overlapping needs. Peter Neville, a gastroenterologist who has worked in the NHS for more than 30 years, recently tweeted, "Council funding has been cut and social workers are dealing with huge caseloads, so there are big delays and we can't send the patients safely home until their care package is sorted out, so they wait and wait." With hospital beds remaining unnecessarily occupied, it becomes ever harder for medics to admit new patients. As a result, ambulance crews can't return to the streets to pick up other patients, and the backlog only grows. More than one quarter of all ambulance drop-offs at emergency rooms now involve wait times of more than an hour. Increasingly critically ill patients are being taken to hospitals by Good Samaritan drivers or by hiring Ubers when ambulances are no-shows. And even when they are successfully dropped off, frequently hospitals no longer have bed spaces for new patients. Palliative care doctor and author Rachel Clark recently wrote that patients are dying in corridors, in cupboards, on floors and in stranded ambulances. In one instance, a man with acute appendicitis wasn't admitted to hospital owing to lack of bed space, but was advised not to leave the premises because his appendix was at imminent risk of rupturing. He slept the night in his car in the hospital parking lot. The situation in the UK is so bad that Adrian Boyle, president of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, recently estimated that 500 people a week are now dying because of a slow pace of care and the breakdown of the ambulance service. That's more than the number of people currently dying each week of COVID in the UK. Three-quarters of the Conservative Party's own voters from the last general election in 2019 now tell pollsters they believe the government has mismanaged the NHS, and roughly half of its erstwhile supporters are hostile to the austerity agenda responsible for the cuts to basic social services. Nationally, about 60% of voters support the nurses and ambulance workers in their strike actions, considerably more than support other strikers such as postal workers, border patrol officers, and teachers. And according to the latest polling, only about 1 in 5 voters intend to vote Conservative in the next general elections. It's a stunning reversal of fortunes over a party that in late 2019 was returned to power its fourth election victory in a row with the largest parliamentary majority in a generation. Britain's NHS was once the gold standard for universal healthcare systems worldwide, but these days it is chronically underfunded, often unable to provide prompt treatment even of an emergency nature, and losing a discouragingly large number of vital workers. No wonder the nurses and the ambulance crews have decided that a strike action is their only viable option.